At this point, Dr. Jesse Smith, the local physician, burst into the hall shouting that 12 surgeons were needed at Tripler right away. That did it. Speaker and audience bolted from the room together. Dr. Moorhead and his pickup team of civilian surgeons spent the next 11 hours operating with hardly any break. Once during the afternoon, he dropped down to the mess hall for a bite, ran into Colonel Miller, the hospital commandant. The doctor suggested, perhaps a little wistfully, that maybe he should go on active duty. Miller said he would see what he could do, and a little later poked his head into the operating room. "You're in the army now." To Dr. Moorhead, this wonderful service was even more wonderful. No forms, questionnaires, or fingerprints, yet he had become a full colonel in 2 hours. As he worked away, Colonel Moorhead displayed a mixture of competence and optimism that did wonders for the wounded. "Son," he told one boy, "you've been through a lot of hell, and you're going into some more. This foot has to come off. But there's been many a good pirate with only one leg." The wounded needed this kind of cheerfulness. Without it, another boy who had lost a leg wanted only to die. He was sure his girl would no longer have him. Private Edward Oveca had a shattered leg, too, and after he came out of ether, he was afraid to see if he still had his foot. He finally worked up his courage and took a look. It was still there. Whatever their feelings, the men were incredibly quiet and uncomplaining. At Queen's Hospital, one man lay riddled with shrapnel. When Dr. Forrest Pinkerton began explaining that he would have to delay treating the less serious wounds, the man calmly broke in, "Just do what you can. I know there are other people waiting." Occasionally, the mildest of disagreements would arise. At Hickam, Captain Carl Hoffman thought a drink might buck up a badly wounded major. He was telling someone to measure a shot when the major interrupted, "Don't tell him how much to put in the glass. Fill it up." At the Navy hospital, a seaman with a bad stomach wound wanted orange juice, but the doctor thought this would be fatal and ordered water instead. When the man objected, the doctor finally whispered to the nurse to get the juice. He would probably die anyway. "I heard you, doctor," called the seaman, "and I still want orange juice." Perhaps due to this sort of determination, a week later the man was doing fine. Everyone did his best to make the wounded comfortable. Morphine did its work, too, and many drifted off to fitful sleep. Radioman Glenn Lane awoke long enough in the hospital ship Solace to see an attendant bending over him with some soup. The man was Filipino, and Lane started with fright. He was sure he had been captured by the Japanese. A man didn't need narcotics to see himself in enemy hands. Dark, dreary thoughts ran through the minds of many still able to fight. Chief Peter Chang saw himself pulling a rickshaw. Fireman John Gabidas expected to be a corpse or a prisoner, but he prayed that Chief Metalsmith Burl W. Brookshire would somehow survive to inspire others with the courage he had given the men on the Rigel. Electrician's mate James Powers thought about those Oriental brain tortures, then remembered he was a Texan and decided to make this another Alamo. Actually, the only Japanese invasion of the Hawaiian Islands was by now well underway. It was just about church time when it all began on Niihau, westernmost island of the Hawaiian chain. Niihau was privately owned by the Robinson family, who operated the island mainly as a sheep and cattle ranch, and lovingly preserved it as a pure Polynesian paradise. No visitors, no modern conveniences, no Western gadgets like guns, telephones, or radios. Once a week, a boat came over from Kauai, 20 miles away, and left supplies at Key Landing on the island's northern tip. There was no other communication with the outside world. In case of serious trouble, it was arranged that a signal fire would be built on a mountain in sight of Kauai. Otherwise, it was just assumed that everything was all right. And this Sunday everything was all right, as the islanders flocked to the little church in Pu'uwai, about 15 miles down the west shore from Key Landing. Pu'uwai was the only village on the island, a collection of small houses scattered among the rocks, cactus, and kiawa trees. Everybody lived there except the Robinsons, who had a homestead at Kiekie, 2 miles away. But just as everyone was entering the church, two planes flew overhead. The islanders all noticed that one plane was sputtering and smoking. They all saw red circles under the wings. And even though they were just ranch hands and cowboys, carefully protected from the problems of the world, many of them sensed trouble far more quickly than their sophisticated neighbors on Oahu. Most recognized the Japanese insignia. Some even guessed an attack on Pearl Harbor. About 2 o'clock, one of the planes reappeared, circling low over the pastures and hedges. The pilot picked out a spot and bounced to a heavy landing. He bumped over some rocks, threw a fence, and stopped near the house of Hawila Kaleohano. There was trouble right away. Awila ran up and yanked open the canopy. The pilot reached for a pistol. Awila grabbed it first and pulled the aviator from the plane. Then the pilot began searching inside his shirt. Awila tore it open and snatched out some papers and a map. By now the whole island was crowding around. The villagers were shouting questions and the pilot was shaking his head, trying to show that he didn't understand English. He could only speak Japanese. There was just one thing to do. Send for Harada, one of the two Japanese on Niihau. He was a 30-year-old Nisei, who had come to the island a year ago as a housekeeper, now worked as both the Robinson's caretaker and an assistant bookkeeper. The head beekeeper was the other Japanese, an old man named Sintani, who had lived on Niihau for many years. Even with Harada's help, no one got much out of the pilot. He said he flew over from Honolulu. He denied any raid. He was vague about the reason for his trip and all those bullet holes in the plane. Finally, the islanders decided to hold him for Mr. Aylmer Robinson himself, who was due in Monday on the weekly boat from Kauai. He would know what to do. Monday morning, they escorted the pilot to Key Landing and guarded him there all day, but the boat never came. Tuesday, they tried again. Still no boat. Wednesday and Thursday passed, and by now the islanders were thoroughly alarmed. Harada came up with a bright idea. Wouldn't it help to move the pilot from Pu'uai to his place at Kiekie? This might calm down the village. Everyone agreed, and it was done. By Friday, it was high time for a signal fire. A group of men went off to build it, and everyone else settled down for another tense day of waiting. At Kiekie, a lone Hawaiian named Haniki watched the pilot. In the last day or so, the Japanese had opened up a good deal. At first, he admitted that he could read and write English, even if he couldn't speak it. Later, that there had indeed been a raid on Pearl Harbor. But he said he liked it here and hoped to settle down on Niihau after the war was over. He apparently wasn't such a bad fellow after all. The pilot asked if he could see Harada, and Haniki took him over to the honey house. The two Japanese talked together for a few minutes. Then all three men strolled into an adjoining storehouse where the nets and hives were kept. Haniki suddenly found himself facing two guns. Harada had stolen a revolver and shotgun from the Robinson house, hidden them in the storehouse until the right moment, and now the battle for Niihau was on. The two Japanese locked up Haniki in the storehouse and dashed through the underbrush to the road. They held up a passing sulky, forcing out a Hawaiian woman and seven children. Then they jumped in, pointed the gun at a young girl on the horse, made her drive them to Pu'uai as fast as she could. As they neared the village, they jumped off and raced for Hawila's house to get the pilot's papers. Hawila saw them coming and bolted for the fields. Harada and the airmen searched the house but found nothing. After an unsuccessful attempt to recruit Sintani, Niihau's other Japanese, the two men started searching through all the houses in the village. Again and again they shouted for Hawila, threatened to shoot everyone unless he was immediately produced. But this was an empty threat because almost all the villagers were now hiding in the fields. They did find an ancient woman, Mrs. Haluolani, who stayed behind reading her Bible. She ignored their threats, and not knowing quite how to handle her, they left her. They had a better idea anyhow. They stripped the Japanese plane of its machine guns and once again walked among the houses. This time they yelled that they would shoot up the whole place unless they found Hawila. As it grew dark, they began ransacking the homes in earnest. They ripped apart Hawila's house and finally discovered the pilot's pistol and map, but still no sign of his papers. They worked on through the night, turned the houses inside out, one after the other. Toward dawn on Saturday the 13th, they were back at Hawila's house for one last search. Again no luck, so they burned the place down, hoping to destroy the papers too. All this time, except for a brief period around 3 a.m., curious eyes peeked at the two Japanese from the bushes and weeds that grew in the rocky fields. The islanders had by no means accepted the capture of Pu'uai, but after all, the Japanese had the only guns on Niihau. At a strategy meeting in the cactus grove behind the village, it was decided to send the women and children to some caves in the hills, then return after dark and try to capture the two men. Somehow this plan fell through, but Benny Kanahali and another Hawaiian did manage to steal all the machine gun ammunition, and that was a big step forward. Meanwhile, Hawila had hurried up the mountain to tell the men to get the signal fire going. But when they heard the news, they decided the fire wouldn't tell enough of the story. They must go themselves. So six of the men ran to Key Landing, jumped in a whaleboat, rowed off for help. After 16 hours of steady rowing, they reached Kauai at 3 o'clock Saturday afternoon. They found Aylmer Robinson. He found the military authorities, and a detachment of soldiers, the six Hawaiians, and Mr. Robinson himself were soon racing back to the rescue in the lighthouse tender Kukui. Long before they got there, the invasion had reached its climax. About 7 a.m., Benny Kanahali, having succeeded in stealing the ammunition during the night, tried his luck again. He sneaked back to the village to see what was going on. His wife came with him, and they were both promptly captured. There were the usual demands for Hawila, but Benny was now tired of the whole thing. He told Harada to take the gun away from the pilot before he hurt somebody. Harada said he couldn't, so Benny jumped the man himself. Then his wife piled in, then Harada on top of her, and for a few seconds the four of them scuffled about. Harada pulled the woman away. She kicked and clawed as hard as she could. Benny yelled to leave her alone, or it would be Harada's turn next. The pilot jerked his arm free and shot Benny three times, groin, stomach, and upper leg. According to legend, at this point, Benny got mad. As a matter of fact, he was mad already. But he did now think he might die, and he decided to kill the pilot before he could hurt anyone else. With a great heave, he picked the man up by his neck and one leg, he had often done it to a sheep, and smashed his head against a stone wall. Harada took one look, let Benny's wife go, pointed the shotgun at himself, and pulled the trigger.